In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. Past guest Judith Very Baker, author of Letters to the Cyborgs. As humans become 51% machine or more, who will inherit the Earth? Described possible futures that lay before humanity as artificial intelligence exponentially develops from present-day technology. Two decades have passed since the initial human mass migration into cyberspace. Right now we have immediate access to the publicly gathered knowledge of human civilization, and the self-teaching potential is at its highest. In this what some call a post-human state, we are rewiring our psychology, reshaping consensus reality, and modifying our behavior. With the many benefits of accessing and connecting via internet come a range of downsides within human behavior, such as cyberbullying, sadistic trolling, normalizing fetishes, and checking our internet access hundreds of times a day on average. Are latent human genetic traits finding new life in the cyber world? Our guest, Dr. Mary Akin, author of The Cyber Effect, a pioneer cyberpsychologist, explains how human behavior changes online. She specializes in the impact of technology on human behavior and has written extensively on issues relating to the intersection between humankind and technology. Mary is an adjunct associate professor at University College Dublin, Geary Institute for Public Policy, and academic advisor, psychology, to the European Cybercrime Center at Europol, and has conducted research training workshops with multiple global agencies from Interpol to the FBI and the White House. Her groundbreaking work inspired the CBS television series CSI Cyber. Dr. Mary Akin, welcome to Another News.
Thank you, Jeff.
To start off, could you explain to listeners what a cyber psychologist is?
Cyber psychology is the study of the impact of technology on human behavior. So I provide insight at that intersection between humans and technology, or as law enforcement say, where humans and technology collide.
Got it. Okay. In a past show, we were taking listener phone calls, and several callers described how compulsive phone use changed typical human behavior in the streets of New York City, I would say in a lot of other places as well. But you see it here maybe a little bit more than you would in a suburban area. For example, people standing motionless, hunched over their device in the middle of the sidewalk, maybe a crosswalk or in the street. And amid generations of young people staring into their screen is a growing apathy to engage in verbal communication, let alone face-to-face conversation. But there's more to it, because you wrote about parents using cell phones or tablets to babysit children, and that article struck a nerve in the UK. Can you talk about that aspect of your research?
Absolutely. I was researching a paper a few years ago. I'm very interested in the developmental aspects of the impact of technology on human behavior. So if you take myself or you, Jeff, you know, we're probably done, we're cooked. Not a lot is going to change in terms of exposing ourselves to new stimuli. But for an infant, they're going through these incredible developmental periods all the way through childhood. And I just became fascinated by the potential impact of technology on the developing infant and the developing child. So I started doing research in this area. And I was very surprised to find a paper by the American Academy of Pediatrics, which was published in 2011, where they actually recommended no screen time effectively for children under the age of 2. And I thought, goodness, you know, does anybody know about this? Do parents know about this? And I started researching it, and I wrote about it extensively in my book, because I thought it was something that parents should know about, that it wasn't recommended for very young infants to interact with technology. And then I thought about it a little more, and I thought, well, whatever about the infant using technology, infants grow up in this sort of, you know, this zone of proximal development where they interact with their environment. And I began to think about the caregiver or the parent's use of cell phones. And there's a study which shows that the average person looks at their cell phone 200 times a day. And I thought, well, if you're the parent or a caregiver of a young infant, and if you're looking at your cell phone 200 times a day, well, then that's 200 times that you're not making eye contact with your child. And that's a problem, because babies need FaceTime and not the app sort of FaceTime. And it's absolutely fundamental in terms of bonding for the infant to bond with the parent and for the parent to bond with the infant. So I describe it in my book as an evolutionary blip. The point is that a baby's face is designed to be the most engaging thing on the planet. And that's why the internet is full of pictures of infants and kittens and puppies. Until the arrival of the smartphone, something has come along that is more engaging than the face of an infant. And that's a problem. That's a problem for bonding, for attachment, for infants, and for parents. So I write about it to draw attention to it.
Why do you think it struck a nerve with the readers of that article?
I think because people haven't thought about it. I think that, first of all, a lot of parents were thrusting devices at their infants and toddlers, probably because they thought it could be good for them, could actually help accelerate their skills or their tech skills. So I think people were blindsided by the fact that, ooh, actually this could be negative for the developing child. And then I think more than that, they hadn't really thought about their own cell phone use in terms of when they're in their home and actually when they're spending time with their young children. So I suppose it was just because people really haven't thought about it. And certainly I've had so many people write to me online through my website or contact me to say that they've actually modified their behavior, that they just became aware of their use of their phone and they've modified their behavior to use their phone less, particularly when they're around very young children, their own very young children. So that's a positive outcome.
There's also the connection with the monkeys in the mirror. You raised the question, could young people who have grown up with too much technology and not enough face-to-face interaction with peers remain more isolated like the monkey isolates, retreating to the comfort of their own digital reflection rather than turning to their friends and family for comfort and physical interaction?
It's a fascinating area. I mean, I have to say that a lot of the things that I write about in the book are hypothetical. In other words, we have a certain amount of evidence, and I'm making these intuitive and informed leaps and assumptions to say, well, you know, we have studies about monkeys and mirrors and how identity is formed and how they actually conceive of themselves, and how do then I apply that to teenagers and taking selfies and the selfie being the mirror and the representation of self and becoming consumed with that and isolated as a result. And really in 10 years' time, we'll have the longitudinal studies that say, you know, if a child does this online or does this with their device over this period of time, here's the result. But I didn't want to wait for that. So in a scientific context, I'm going out on a limb, if you will. You know, I say strongly in the introductory chapter to my book that scientists can't metaphorically sit on the fence. You know, we have to nail our colors to the mast and say, well, look, this is what we know, and this is what we think might be happening. And we need to pay attention. And we'll have the studies in time, but in the meantime, we need to pay attention. So I think that young people could be particularly vulnerable prior to going through stages of identity formation. So Erikson a famous researcher in this area, argues that identity formation happens between the ages of about 9 and 14, varying from child to child. And that's the point at which you find out who you are. It's the point at which the self integrates and you discover who you are. And the argument I make is that, well, if a child creates a virtual self online, this self, be it on some social media platform and they're 10 or 11 years of age, and by the way, they shouldn't be on these social media platforms at 11 or 12 because 13 is the, under the COPPA regulation, is the age at which you can have a presence online or actually register with one of these platforms. And that's not strictly enforced, and that's a problem in its own right. But we'll come back to that. So the point is that if a child creates a virtual self, and that self, that presence, be it on Facebook or Instagram or whatever platform they choose to use, that self can be a very aspirational self and highly manipulated. So it can be an artifact which is manipulated to have better skin and shinier hair and stretch to be 5 pounds lighter. And it may not fully reflect the real world self. And my concern is that the more the child invests in this virtual self, what happens to the real world self? Does it become this pale reflection that needs to stay in the basement because it can never live up to this creation who is popular, evidenced by hundreds of random connections, witty, evidenced by carefully edited, you know, sound bites in terms of online communication? And effectively, if this entity then is attacked and cyberbullied, and if that's the best the child can be, does it lead to some sort of interpsychic conflict where the virtual self, this creation, turns and looks at the real world self and says, well, if I'm a loser and I'm fat or ugly or no good, then you certainly are no good. And my hypothesis was that this might lie at the root of maybe potentially self-harm as a result of cyberbullying, that interpsychic conflict within the child itself, an interpsychic conflict in the child's own cognitive processing and not outside of that process.
You really break it down in your book, and I read that about 25% of teenagers report cyberbullying, and about 7% of them are pushed to commit self-harm or suicide. And there's a story about a young woman who killed herself because of cyberbullying. Can you talk about how bullying in the digital world has such a major impact, and what are online giants such as Google and Facebook doing to minimize the potential?
Yeah, cyberbullying, it's a terrible evolution of technology. I mean, I'm essentially pro-technology. I couldn't do my work as a cyber psychologist without technology. And technology in itself is not good or bad. It's either used well or poorly by humans. But the real question that I would like answered is that real-world bullying is a problem. Why? Because there's no evidence. A punch in the playground, a harsh word. Cyberbullying is actually nothing but digital evidence. In fact, you cannot cyberbully without leaving a digital trail of some sort. So how did we ever get to the point where cyberbullying was a greater problem than real-world bullying? And, you know, to paraphrase one of my favorite movies, the greatest trick that the social media companies have ever pulled is to convince us they can do nothing about cyberbullying. The point is that we're so, as a society, and especially when it comes to technology and anything online, we're so hung up on surveillance that we don't want to move towards methodologies that might be able to track, for example, cyberbullying. But what we need to remember is that cyberbullying predominantly affects children, and they are minors. So using some sort of technology solution, be it algorithmic or otherwise, to monitor the process is not surveillance when it comes to minors. It's actually parenting. And it could be done as an opt-in with consent. Parents could say, I would like to be the first to know my child is being cyberbullied and not the last. And that case you referred to, Brandy Vela, the Texas case, that is tragic, you know, beyond comprehension, where she actually killed herself in front of her parents. Devastating, absolutely devastating for a family. We have to be careful about causation and correlation to say that cyberbullying causes self-harm attempts or even suicide attempts, because that scientifically is not clearly established. But certainly it is what I describe as cyber feral behavior. Young people engaging in feral behavior online. And effectively, one of the reasons they will do it is because online there is a perception that nobody is in charge. And the reality is that nobody is in charge. So it isn't any surprise that we have these types of behavior manifesting, because this is an environment, cyberspace is an environment where children, kids, teenagers are free to act more or less in any way that they feel like acting, and there are little or no consequences to their behavior. And we're all familiar with the encryption debate with Apple and the FBI and the whole piece about encryption. I get very worried. I'm somebody who works actively with law enforcement, with policing, as a scientific advisor. And I get very worried when we start moving to a time and a place where there are domains, be they real world or cyber, that are effectively beyond the law. And I get even more worried when I see the use of encryption around the behavior of children, because that also puts that behavior beyond the law and beyond parenting. These are important moral and cyber ethical issues that we need to talk about. We need to have this conversation.
It would be a very important conversation, and to distinguish between an overly surveilled platform and installing an algorithm to monitor cyberbullying, I'm sure that could be done. It doesn't seem like it's impossible. The other aspect is teaching children about resilience and the process of essentially adapting well in the face of adversity. You write about that. Can you tell listeners about the nuances of that discussion?
I'm not a big fan of the resilience position. You know, it's the default position that we have now as a society, and many programs recommend that you teach children resilience to cyberbullying online, or resilience to being exposed to extreme content, legal but age inappropriate content, which could be adult pornography, which could be extreme violence, which could be self-harm content like the pro-anorexia websites. Why, as a society, should we teach children resilience to this content? We should never expose children to this content. You teach resilience when you're in a war situation, when you have no choice but to teach, you know, young people or children, well, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to face up to this. Why are we teaching children resilience effectively to their life? And the argument that I make about the internet is that one-third of the users of the internet are children, yet it's not fit for purpose. There is no shallow end of the swimming pool online. We cannot protect children from being exposed to this content. So we say, not we, because I certainly don't agree with it, teach them resilience. And when I talk about this subject, everybody says, well, you know, you can use parental software filters. I would ask any parent who's listening, please go and search bypassing parental controls, and you'll get a million results. You won't sleep tonight, but you're going to know what your kids know. So we come back to this premise of, if the internet, if so many kids are using it, why can't we make a better effort to make it a safer place for them? And I don't mean safe in terms of just the standard child safety issues in terms of being wary of predators online. I mean safe in terms of their mental health, safe in terms of their development. And in fact, the UN Convention on the Rights of a Child enshrines a child's right to a healthy mental and physical development. And if you look at the document, in fact, nowhere is the, it was 1989 when it was first published, nowhere are the words digital or internet or cyber used. So I'm part of the Hague Justice Portal, which is an entity in the Hague where we actually raise social justice issues. And I had the pleasure of meeting with the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, or for the Rights of the Child, for Human Rights, where I raised this issue in terms of the rights of the child, that asking the Commissioner formally to consider amending the UN Convention on the Rights of a Child to incorporate the rights of a child in a cyber context. Children have a right to a healthy mental and physical development, including healthy mental and physical development online.
It seems to me that it would be inevitable children would see extreme content, and that by teaching resilience may not be the only solution, but it might be part of a bigger solution. It's a difficult area. It's really difficult.
No, it's a terrible protocol, because we're missing the point. Do you think you should sit down with a 7-year-old or 8-year-old or 9-year-old and expose them to hardcore pornography? I mean, do we not think as a society we're losing something of ourselves when we have to do that? Or do we just look at it and say, we need to rethink this? I'm not the sort of academic that believes in sticking my finger in the hole in the dam. You know, I refuse to sort of engage in these, well, let's stick a patch on it, and let's stick a patch here, and let's, you know, let's not be critical of the internet because it's all good. I look at it and say, just a minute, you know, we've lost our moral compass here. We need to really think about this, and we need to think, you know, should children even be online? You know, you can engage with technology offline. You can have air-gapped systems. It's not mutually exclusive. But at the moment, when they are online and when we can't protect them, and when I say children, I'm talking about, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9-year-old, that sort of age group, not so much the teenagers, because you might hope that at that stage they had at least some skills to protect themselves and they wouldn't be developmentally as vulnerable. But, for example, we are seeing early warning signs of post-traumatic stress disorder in content moderators who work in the Far East, taking down extreme content online. So they're used as human filters, effectively, to take down extreme violence and extreme content all day long, and child abuse material. It's not a stretch to think that children will begin to suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of being exposed to this content. So teaching resilience could be an emergency approach, but it's gone on for too long. And I'm all in favor of having, to your point, some sort of a stopgap. Well, we have to do this while we figure out how to fix it. But my problem is nobody is actively trying to figure out how to fix it and how do we protect children. The American military have a thing called Nippernet. It's an internet within the internet, or intranet within the internet. Why don't we have a Nippernet for kids? Why do we have the military operating in a safe place, but we can't create something similar for children? great societies are not judged by how they protect those who are strong. They are judged by how they protect those who are most vulnerable. And children are vulnerable online.
Listeners, if you're just tuning in, our guest is Dr. Mary Akin, author of the book, The Cyber Effect, a pioneering cyber psychologist, explains how human behavior changes online. Dr. Akin, you write about the 2014 news of a pedophile posting hundreds of photos of himself having sex with young boys. He would pixelate his face or use a digital swirl to distort his image. I remember when this story came out.
Mm-hmm.
But you worked with the Interpol agent who had this case. Can you remind listeners about how this investigation played out?
Sure, there was a famous case, and in fact, the Interpol officer who was actually working the case is a great friend and colleague of mine, an Irish policeman originally called Mick Moran, a strapping great guy who just, when he walks into a room, everybody knows he's there, and he's passionate. And one thing that he said, and it's always sort of stayed with me, is that he said, when it comes to child abuse material, you know, child abuse material is how we describe child pornography. We don't use that term. We talk about child abuse material. He says that every image is a crime scene. And I think it's an incredible description of, you know, something that is so corrosive in terms of and so damaging. And we, NCMEC, which is the National Center for Missing Exploited Children, they 10 years ago, they were getting 10,000 child abuse images a year. Last year, they got 20 million. So this is a big data problem. And the particular case that you're talking about, the offender had actually used technology to obfuscate or to hide their own features by turning their face into a swirl. And McMoran actually used a technology solution in that he got a German lab to actually unswirl the face. And the image was made public by Interpol. They actually, so they went online to sort of, well, crowdsource tips to actually identify this offender. And they got a couple of hundred tips from the public. And the offender was actually recognized by a member of his own family. He was identified as Christopher Paul Neal, who was a school teacher and a former chaplain. So he had been working in South Korea, then he went to Bangkok, and Interpol followed him there, and he was arrested and then prosecuted. And at the time, McMoran had said that, you know, the irony that the fact that they used technology to track him down and to publicize the message was not lost. You know, this was a technology-mediated crime, and they actually used technology to solve it.
The solution was in the environment.
Absolutely. But it raises an interesting issue about the whole genre, I suppose, of, you know, true crime and the role of the online environment in actually and crowdsourcing opinion in terms of criminal activity.
It certainly does. As a forensic cyberpsychologist, Dr. Akin, you learned to recognize these patterns. For example, the current Pizzagate story, we've been following it on this show, reporting on the public revulsion and the subsequent print media stories, essentially calling it fake news, which is not entirely true. However, amid the vigilantism and death threats, there's a decent citizen journalism revealing important evidence for authorities, such as the FBI, to pick up on. Have you been following this, and how does this scenario fit in with your research?
Yes, certainly. I'm aware of it. You know, I'm sort of loath to add to the cyber noise in terms of this sort of phenomenology. And the reason being that the process of investigation of criminal activity is a very specific one. It's a very controlled one. When you get the phenomenon of the cyber vigilantes or the cyber mob, due process is abandoned. And sometimes you may get a good outcome, and I'm not denying that, but very often people can be damaged or hurt or incriminated in something where we haven't had due process, you know, where the cyber mob has become the judge, the jury, and the executioner, if you will. I'm somebody who's pro-social order and pro using a systematic methodology to investigate serious crime. So I'm not denying that there is value in crowdsourcing opinion, but I would be very interested in that happening in a controlled environment rather than wildcatting.
What does happen with a situation like Pizzagate? Clearly there's an issue with the cyber mob, but there's also something there to investigate.
Mm-hmm.
Does the FBI...
Allegedly, there's something there, just to clarify.
Well, I would say there is something there to investigate.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying anyone's guilty of anything, but I think there are many threads to pull because of the images that were shown on this individual's Instagram account. And does the FBI pick up on something like this, or do they just sit and wait?
Well, I can't speak for the FBI, and I'm not working on this case, but just as a general observation,
right?
I'm you know, certainly law enforcement, if something is brought to their attention, they're very, you know, they're very receptive to getting those sort of tips or feedback. But again, I come back to the control piece. There's a difference between calling a hotline or sending in a cyber tip. There's a difference between that and the sort of, you know, viral entity that we are witnessing. And I suppose as a cyber psychologist, I would do a deeper dive into a couple of things. I mean, can you really say that this, you know, what they call fake news, can you say it's fake news, or do you say it's news, or do you say it's actually gossip? And, you know, it accelerates and amplifies into something else. There was a study, I think was done by the University of Amsterdam, and they actually found that 90% of total office conversation qualified as gossip. So, you know, as humans, anthropologists argue that gossip is a way that humans bond with each other. So you can take some of these fake news stories and conceptualize them as gossip, and then they get to a point where they get out of control. Now factor in investigative methods. The particular case that you're talking about, people came across images, and they then did content analysis of the images, which is a particular forensic tool that people like me would use in a law enforcement environment, and you extrapolate data from the image or from captions attached to the image. But again, come back to control and come back to the investigative process. And, you know, does a million tweets help the process, or does it obfuscate and cloud the issues? And what about people who get caught up in this, who may or may not be guilty? Certainly some may be guilty, but what about those who are not, who are maybe bystanders, or who are dragged into something that has nothing to do with them, but they're caught up in this phenomenon that we in cyber psychology, we call it, you know, outrage culture. And I'm just not in favor of abandoning due process. But that said, there can be merit in actually those sort of tips being handed over to law enforcement. I would just like to see more control and potentially less collateral damage for those who ultimately may turn out to be innocent bystanders and not involved with the allegations, but can get caught up in it.
In your chapter titled Normalization of a Fetish, you talk about online syndication. Can you talk about your research into this term and the odds of certain types of people finding each other, such as psychopaths?
Yes, I mean, you know, the beauty of the internet is connectivity. It allows all sorts of people to reach out and to connect with each other. And in my book, I write about a lot of negative aspects of everything that technology can deliver to society. And the reason that I do that is that we've an army of marketeers out there telling us everything is fantastic. And I just wanted to introduce some balance into the debate and say, yes, the internet and technology per se is fantastic, the connectivity, the democratization of knowledge, the educational opportunities, the vitality of the tech industry, these are all fantastic things, but there are downsides. And we need to be aware of them in order to design around them. And in particular, I point to a number of phenomenons that I think are interesting, and I conceptualize them and frame them as theoretical constructs. I mean, one of the problems is that the behavioral sciences, to a certain extent, has been blindsided by evolutions in technology in the profound and pervasive impact of technology on humankind. And we have to question whether theories that we have developed and tested in the real world are still relevant online. Do they need to be updated, or do we need to add to them or modify them? And one of the theoretical constructs that I proposed in the book was the construct of online syndication. It's really the mathematics of human behavior. So if we think about abnormal behavior, to date, in a real-world context, abnormal behavior has been capped or bound by the laws of probability and domain. So, for example, I'm a 13-year-old girl with an eating disorder in the south of the country, and you're a 13-year-old girl with an eating disorder in the north of the country. What was the probability of us coming in contact with each other? It was going to be a very rare, low probability that it might happen. Mm-hmm. So in our own family, with our own friends, nobody would socialize or normalize that behavior. They would say, no, you need to eat, or you don't want to get too thin, or you're going to damage your health. But online, within a couple of clicks and under the cover of anonymity and fueled by online disinhibition, these abnormal population in terms of their behavior can find each other readily. And they can then normalize and socialize that behavior and facilitate it. So whether you're a 13-year-old girl with an eating disorder, whether you're a sex offender with a deviant interest in children, or whether you're a functioning psychopath, you can reach out to find like-minded people online, and they can actually normalize this abnormal behavior. I'm very concerned about it, and I think it poses a significant threat to society, because what it may do is actually drive the incidence of this abnormal behavior in general population. So it's something we need to be very aware of, and we need to actively address and to think about it.
Can you give listeners some examples of online syndication manifesting in the real world?
To engage in this behavior in a real-world context, to look for others who are like-minded, the offender actively places themselves at risk of detection until they move online. And the point at which they move online, they can operate in an anonymous way, and that can facilitate and drive the behavior, which arguably could drive incidents of the behavior. So it's very much a predictive entity. It's looking forward and saying, well, what's going to happen in 5 years' time or 10 years' time? And that percentage that we have now, is that going to be the same percentage, or is it going to increase? You know, there are two ways of looking at the connectivity that is delivered by the internet. We can say that it causes bad behavior, and that's one, you know, argument. I personally don't think that. I don't believe in the causation model. I think it mediates human behavior. Or, on the other side, we can look at it and say, well, actually, what the internet does is this connectivity it allows a tapping into human consciousness, and it manifests as evidence in a cyber context, and that what the connectivity of the internet does and the evidence that we see being produced as a result of that connectivity, that what the internet is doing is actually shining a very bright light into the darkest reaches of the human psyche. And maybe we're all just Game of Thrones underneath it all.
Yes, it certainly is. And are latent human genetic traits finding new life in the cyber world?
Yeah, I think, you know, we've had, 10,000 years of evolving as a species. And if you look at infants, you know, when they're born, they bite and they kick and they scratch, and we have to tell them, no, don't do that. And I get very concerned when I see negative behavior online that effectively, you know, this the facility to behave in an anonymous way without consequences might actually be tapping into behavior that's been suppressed and repressed for a long time from, you know, in our societies, and now it's being allowed to flourish. And that's not a good thing. It's not a good thing for humankind. Well, I firmly believe it's not a good thing. We want to live in caring, inclusive societies. We don't want to go back to, you know, the Dark Ages, as I say, Game of Thrones. We don't want to be barbarian.
Well, Dr. Aiken, speaking of games, a generation of gamers have become adult age now, and there are more to follow. As tragic as they are, would you take us through some of the cases that you write about?
Yeah, I pointed to a number of cases where people had died as a result of excessive gaming behavior. And I think when I was writing the book, you know, some of the editors working with me, the publishers, they said, oh my goodness, you know, more death. And, you know, my world is forensics, so I use these examples to make a point. But equally, I'm saying these are extreme behaviors. It was the example of a 20-year-old Chris Staniforth from Sheffield in England, who actually, after a day of marathon gaming, he woke up in the middle of the night. He had a strange feeling in his chest, and they dashed him to hospital, but he died of a pulmonary embolism. It was a blood clot that had formed, and that was a deep vein thrombosis. And effectively, it was from sitting for long periods of time engaging in his hobby, which was gaming. And what we're seeing, there are a couple of other examples that I give of the same thing happening, a young man called Chuang in Taiwan. I also pointed to a very tragic story of a young couple who had an infant baby. I'm sure some people had heard about this. And they actually were playing a game called Prius online, and it was a virtual world. And they were caring for a virtual baby that they called Anima in that virtual world. And they were leaving their home to go and play in, you know, PC bangs or cafes, effectively. And they neglected their own child. So they were caring for this virtual infant, but their actual infant at home died of malnutrition at 3 months of age. And actually, HBO did a documentary called Love Child about it. I also mention as well in the book about the capturing of gaming freakouts, and especially of young children, you know, freaking out because something goes wrong when they're playing their game, but that then being captured and posted and using to humiliate the child, which is not fair for a young person, for that sort of record to be permanently circulated. And I suppose I, you know, went into a deeper dive in terms of looking at internet addiction and looking at specifically internet gaming disorder. And in fact, a study that I've just completed recently for Europol, where I was the principal investigator, we were looking at youth hacking and pathways into cybercrime. And in fact, we found a significant relationship between population who like to engage in hacking and some gaming protocols in terms of the addictive and compulsive nature of the behavior and an overlap between the two. So I think in terms of areas of study, we, from a behavioral science point of view, we're still really reaching and searching to understand the fundamentals of the drivers behind the behavior. If you look at DSM, which is the Bible for psychologists, it's a diagnostic and manual, effectively. And internet gaming disorder isn't a full clinical condition. It's an area of interest for DSM. And I think we urgently need more studies to investigate the behavior, but also neurological drivers behind the behavior. For example, potentially the release of dopamine while people are gaming, which is a feel-good entity, which may actually contribute to engaging with the behavior over longer periods of time because it's essentially rewarding. So I think in order to advise how best people can engage with their pastimes, with their hobbies, in a way that's constructive, we need more research to be able to advise the process. In a parallel way, one clinical entity that's becoming very apparent is that we often say that women are treated very badly online in terms of misogyny, and they're at risk for all sorts of attacks because of their gender. But what we find in current research that actually young men are suffering at the hands of their interaction with technology, in terms of we're seeing increasing levels of social isolation in young men as a result of the fact that they're becoming consumed by their relationship with technology to the point where they're becoming socially isolated. And anecdotally, they say I've heard from a number of universities, in the first year in university, the sort of clubs that they have where people go and they meet, whether they're going to learn to, you know, play hockey or debate or whatever the college might have an offer, they're finding it very difficult to attract young males. All the girls show up, but they don't have any of the young guys showing up, and they're probably back in the dorm online gaming.
What has your research turned up on those involved in game design? Yes, they're designed to addict, but could you talk about it psychologically and maybe visually and gambling philosophy involved?
Yeah, the whole point about game design, the problem that I have with game design is that, you know, particularly for young people, I'm talking about kids who are engaged in online gaming, is in normal gameplay, if you have 20 kids playing, you know, ten-a-side football or what we call soccer, after, you know, 30 minutes, they're starting to tire. And after an hour, they're certainly tired. And the level of the game actually diminishes in a natural way. So everybody starts full of energy running around playing the game. And then over time, the level of the game will drop off as the young person tires. The problem with the gaming design, or what I perceive as the problem, is that when you start to engage, as you proceed over time, the game increases in difficulty. And I consider that to be a fundamental problem in terms of game design, particularly for young kids, because you see then these freakouts, these outbursts of temper and frustration, because the child is becoming physically exhausted, and at the point at which the child's exhaustion measure increases, the game actually gets more difficult. So you get to this almost crisis point, which you end up in almost in a breakdown. And I don't think that's good in terms of game design, and particularly for young kids.
Dr. Aiken, how aware is the corporate world to their influence on reshaping human behavior via internet devices, games, and social media?
The sophisticated operators in the tech industry are very aware of how they can manipulate human behavior. And I think as a society, it's something that has ethical issues, cyber ethical issues. We have to think very carefully about the impact of artificial intelligence, algorithmic-based AI, on humans, on humankind. And we should be very protective of that interface in terms of have some form of oversight or even good practice. And I'm not talking about regulation. I just mean good practice and governance and ethics around the interaction between artificial intelligence and humans. I mean, if you look at search at the moment, it's an algorithmically based entity. It makes associations for humans. But if you have a 13-year-old girl who's got body dysmorphic issues, and she sits down and she types thin into search and presses return, and she's led to the horrendous websites that promote self-harm and eating disorders, who is morally and ethically responsible for that process? And it's important for us to really think about how much do we want to be shaped by these algorithms. And whatever about the algorithms we have at the moment, as search starts moving towards what they call deep learning or a learning AI, even the engineers behind search openly admit that they will lose control of the process. So an algorithm is rule-based. You know, it will do 2 plus 2 equals 4. When you move to a deep learning AI, it begins to evolve its own rule set. And does that algorithm take into account the greater good for humankind? Now we're moving into the area of artificial intelligence incorporated in robotics and the impact of that on humankind. And when people talk about the problem space, they worry about artificial intelligence and robots taking our jobs. I'm much more worried about the impact of artificial intelligence on society, on who we are. I mean, I'll give you an example. If you give a learning AI a problem set and said, could you come up with a cure for cancer? The learning AI could go away and think about it and then come back and say, actually, I've searched everything about this and I've done this incredible audit and I now have a cure for cancer. And everybody could say, wow, this is fantastic. Artificial intelligence has actually designed a cure for cancer. But the AI might decide it could cure cancer by killing all humans. And that's a typical example of an algorithmic learning AI solution to a problem set. It's very logical, but it's not what we want as a society.
It's funny that you use that example with the Japan example earlier. It's very interesting what we seem to be up against right now.
Yes, I think it's that these are issues that we need to think about. We need to debate them. I'm a big fan of Stephen Hawking and his work. We really need to just have the conversation as a society. How do we create better cyber society? Because what happens in a cyber context impacts on the real world and vice versa. And these questions are important questions that need to be thoroughly debated by humankind.
Well, I really appreciate you writing this valuable book. I think it's extremely important to
thank you.
Distill all of this information that you've worked on and collected over a long period of time. And I understand that you wouldn't be writing another book for a while because there's a lot in this book. There is a lot of information in this book, and it will help, I think, human beings take another look at what's going on with technology. Dr. Mary Akin, author of The Cyber Effect, thank you so much for being on In Other News.
Thank you, Jeff. Yeah, thank you for taking the time to talk about it.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.